Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Girls Talk Crime. I'm Georgia.
I'm Amy.
And oh yeah, we forgot. Jenny's not here.
Nah.
She's actually really quite poorly today. She's had quite a severe f***ing accident and there's blood and shit everywhere. So rest in peace, Jenny, and you know, we will like help pay for decorators for the bathroom and the bedroom.
I really wasn't expecting anything, I have to say.
Well, who knows what Jenny gets up to.
I thought we were going to be a bit more parent friendly, but
nope. Anyway, in all seriousness, she put in a HR request for a holiday. So a holiday request to HR. That's us.
We are HR.
We are HR, and the holiday was approved.
With flying colours.
So enjoy your days off. You now have none left. No more holidays left to take.
We shall see you next week.
So anyway, on the lead up to Halloween, because it is Halloween this week and this episode will be released on Thursday, the 31st of October, we thought we'd do a pretty well-known crime or horror tale to kickstart this week's episode. Later on in the episode, as we already mentioned, Jenny's not here today. She has actually pre-recorded two creepypastas like we did in last week's episode, so we'll pop that on to the end of this podcast. But before that, me and Amy wanted to discuss our own creepy tales because we thought that might be quite fun and interesting for you all. So, Amy, what is your creepy stories?
So, mine's going back to when I was a child and I was sitting at my parents' house on the top of the stairs. And I can't remember why I was sat there. I think it was because my sister was downstairs with her friends and I wasn't allowed down there because I was a child and I was not cool. And I couldn't watch films with them. So I sat at the top of the stairs in a piss. And then in a piss, not in my own piss. Whereas after this happened, I was pretty much sitting in my own piss. Anyway, and a cardigan of my mum's flew from my mum's room and hit me on the head.
That is quite freaky. I would have screamed.
I think I did. Or I froze. I can't quite remember. And then I remember I kind of went into my mum and dad's room to check it out, thinking that maybe mum's in there, and she threw a cardigan at me, which she wouldn't do anyway.
Fuck you, Amy. Get off the top of the stairs.
There was no one in there, which is even worse because I was just there and I need to get out of here. So I'm pretty sure that happened, and I can kind of recall actually seeing it like fly across the room, well, across the landing. And I just kind of told myself, oh, it must have been on the banister and just fell down and hit me on the head. But
it must have just been a tornado in the hallway, and it just a gust of very, very strong wind.
But do you know there's always that bit of like your house or a house that always like creeps you out?
Yes,
that was one bit. And can I say that kind of leads on to another story that from my nan's house. So she's into all that kind of like psychic stuff, and she said that there was a woman that lived in her house, got hit by a car outside, and now she just chills with my nan at the time in her house. And she goes, oh, she's over there right now, and pointed to the door. And ever since, like, she had the scariest fucking house, you know, all the teddies like lined on the stairs.
Why do old people do that? So I'm not like, is this your Irish nan?
No, the other one.
This is the other one.
Yeah.
I was gonna say, why do old people do that though? They do just like have dolls and fucking terrifying ornaments. Like why?
I know.
I mean, I know it's a generation thing, but it's not attractive. They've never been cute. Like, they are terrifying.
So you walk up the stairs and, like, teddies are just like, like, cat the dirt on the stairs.
One's got a knife.
Yeah. But that was the one house I can remember, like, in my whole lifetime that I can never walk around on my own because I always just felt like there was something there. Didn't like it.
My story obviously relates to my dad's old house. And his house used to freak me out quite a lot. And it was, I think, when my little sister, she must have been two. So she was, I think, in, just going into her big bed or about to come out of her cot. You know, she was in that transitional stage, but she was really good. She stayed in her bed the whole night. But on one particular night, I was babysitting, and I was looking after my little sister and my parents' friend's little boy. And he was older than Anya, so he kept coming up and going downstairs to, like, coming downstairs to see me. And I can't sleep, I can't sleep. And I was like, oh. Right, Father Christmas ain't coming, so... Unless you go to sleep. It wasn't Christmas, by the way. But I don't have a lot of patience sometimes. I've got borderline none. So I was like, right, you ain't getting nothing for Christmas. Father Christmas won't get you your robot if you don't go to sleep. And he was like, okay. So it's been a while since I've heard him. So I thought, okay, better go up and check on him. So I went up the stairs. And as I was walking up the stairs, I heard the noise really, really clearly of pots and pans being reassembled in my cupboard. Like, in, you know, when you've got your pots and pans cupboard, and like when you're trying to get a pan out, you're like, oh, that's the pan I want, it's right at the back, and you've got to move all the other ones. I heard that so clearly coming from downstairs, and I was like, oh, for God's sake, he's up. That was my immediate thought. Why aren't you sleeping? And then, but I was on the step that if you stepped just one more, you could see the landing and into the bedroom. So I stood up one more, and I looked through, and his door was open, and his bed was right in front of the door, and he was in it, asleep. And Anya's was closed, and you would have heard hers open. And then I was just like, oh my God, there's someone in the kitchen. And I shit myself. So I went downstairs really slowly, like, obviously, like, freaking out. And I went in, and there was no one there. Like, the cupboard doors were obviously closed and everything like that. And so I just sat in the living room for the rest of the night with the door quite, like, heavily closed. And I had the TV volume up. And I think at the time I had been watching Alien, which is a good film. But if you watch it in the right setting, it can be quite freaky. So I was like, I'm not going to watch any horror films. Let's put a funny one on. And I just had the volume up until my parents came home. And I was like, right, see you later, bye. And another thing as well in my dad's old house, which you can agree is quite freaky. But just, I don't know, there's something about it. It was a nice, well-decorated house. And it's like a terrace house. So it's not like this on its own anywhere. And it was in quite a lively, I suppose, area. Yeah, I didn't like being there on my own at night. I didn't like it. And but when Anya was, I think, maybe like 9, 10, 11 months old, we were playing at the bottom of the stairs, because for some reason babies like doing that, and we had all her little toys. All of a sudden she pointed to the top of the stairs. I can't really explain her face, but she looked scared, and she pointed, and then she like went and like kept pointing and like whimpering, and I was like, right, we're off. So I just like plucked her up off the floor. And for all you listeners, just know there is an 18-year age gap between me and my sister, hence why I was picking her up so easily and driving off.
Yeah. She's actually your twin.
Yeah. Anyway, we rambled enough. We have gone on our, you know, trademark tangent. We do love them. So I don't know if we've already mentioned it, but the case we're covering is the Amityville Horror. So that's the case we're covering today. Wednesday, the 13th of November, 1974, around 3 a.m. in the morning, the following members of the DeFeo family had been murdered in an extremely strange circumstance. The perpetrator had taken the lives of Ronald DeFeo Sr., 44, and Louise DeFeo, 42, the mother and father of the household. The two had been left lying face down on their beds with two bullet wounds from a 35 caliber rifle. This wasn't a double homicide, because also lying face down in their own beds were Dawn, 18, Allison, 13, Mark, 12, and John Matthew, 9. Again, shot with a 35 caliber rifle. So what's happened at the Amityville Horror that night? And what has happened since the night of 1974?
So, on the 13th of November, 1974, around 6:30 p.m, 23-year-old Ronald DeFeo Jr. had apparently found his whole family slaughtered at gunpoint, lying in their own beds in each of their own rooms. So that's his mother, father and younger siblings. After this discovery, Ronald Jr., the eldest son, had apparently gone straight into the local town to get help. Ronald Jr. entered the bar named Henry's Bar in Amityville, Long Island, New York, and declared, "You got to help me. I think my mother and father are shot." So at this point, apparently he was unaware of his younger siblings. Ronald Jr. and a small group of people went to 112 Ocean Avenue, which was located near the bar, and found that Ronald Jr.'s parents were dead inside the house. One of the group, Robert Jr.'s friend Joe Yeswit, made an emergency call to the Suffolk County Police, who searched the house and found that six members of the family were dead in their beds.
So, as mentioned, the DeFeo parents had both been shot twice, while the children had all been killed with single shots. Physical evidence suggests that Louise DeFeo and her daughter, Allison, were both awake at the time of their deaths. The strange thing was that the other victims were all found lying face down in bed. Also, the victims had seemed to be undisturbed, which considering, a killer or killers had been using a very large, loud gun, it seems unlikely there had been no noticeable struggle. So who was Ronald DeFeo Jr.? Ronald was known by his friends as Butch, so to us in England that means having an appearance or qualities of being masculine. Whether that was why he was named that, I don't know. Childhood for Ronald was hard. He was constantly beaten and verbally abused by his father. Reports also say that Ronald Jr.'s friends would never come to the house due to his father and his abusive tendencies.
So let's go back to the night of the 13th of November 1974. At this point, Ronald Jr. was the only survivor of the Amityville house, so obviously fingers were pointing at him. Ronald Jr. firstly claimed to police officers at the scene of the crime that the killings had been carried out by a mob hitman, Louis Fellini?
Fellini.
And this was because Ronald Jr. had had a pass with drugs and gangs. Ronald's getting bonkers.
He was a bad man, okay?
He went and played with all the drugs and the gangs. However, an interview at the station soon exposed serious inconsistencies in this version of events. The following day, he confessed to carrying out the killings himself. Ronald Jr. told detectives, "Once I started, I just couldn't stop. It went so fast." He admitted that he had taken a bath and redressed and detailed where he had discarded crucial evidence, such as bloodstained clothes and the Marlin rifle and cartridges before going to work as usual.
So that's the crime. Ronald Jr. has confessed, but there are a lot of questions surrounding this case, and he's currently serving a 25-year to life plus six concurrent sentences in prison, obviously. So he's actually around 68 now, we believe. So all six of the victims were found face down in their beds with no sign of a struggle. The police investigation concluded that the rifle had not been fitted with a sound suppressor and found no evidence of sedatives having been administered. How could someone in the house not have been awake? How did they not hear the sounds of gunshots? Police officers and the medical examiner who attended the scene were initially puzzled by the speed and scale of the killings and considered the possibility that more than one person had been responsible for the crime. No luck catching them killers then. Some investigators had thought that it had been to do with the mob and it was a stunt to claim the insurance from the father. We've heard this before in a lot of cases and it's surprising how often that this is the motive. It's, 9 out of 10, isn't it? Like, you see a murder, you're like, oh, insurance money. Oh, fuck me, it's insurance money. Like, it's surprising how much people are motivated by money. It's quite disturbing. I mean, I can't say that the thought's not crossed my mind before, I'm quite skint, but I'd have to kill myself. Get my own inheritance money. I'm like, someone shot my cat. I've got her insured for £100 million. She's very rare.
Yeah, she's very rare. Limited edition. Cat.
She's a Gucci cat.
Real fur.
Yeah. So, yeah, it blows my mind how often that's the case.
It also doesn't make sense that it's the mob anyway, because it was one gun that killed all of the people. They'll be able to determine different bullets, wouldn't they?
Typically, mobs, I believe, would use a gun that can be concealed easily, whereas a rifle is a big fucker. You can't really plait in your jeans. Yeah, I've just hung. Got a big load of bullets.
But another theory to this mass murder was that it was originally planned by his 18-year-old sister, Dawn. And reports have said that Ronald and Dawn were very similar in age and close and almost too close. So it may have been a bit incesty.
You need some of that spray then. Good old incest spray. Incesticide. And if you don't know what we're talking about, go back and listen to one of our episodes before. I believe it's the Candyman.
In an interview with Ronald Jr., he had said he was sitting on the sofa watching a war programme on the TV when in came a woman dressed in black and wearing black gloves and handed him the rifle, telling him to commit this murder. It was at this time that a drug law enforcement agent was actually watching the house because he was doing some bad things with drugs and apparently witnessed Dawn leaving the house and she was wearing black. So could this have been Dawn? I didn't really know what this was telling me.
I've lost my train of thought. yeah, so it could have been, could this have been the original plan that they'd both been in on it? Is basically what I'm getting at there.
Okay. I'm just thinking, because if she was dead, then how could she have hidden the gun?
No, but that's the point. So it could
she's
have been.
She's going in with a gun.
They went in initially with a plan that they both do it. And then they're like, maybe she went a bit trigger happy. They just initially meant to kill the parents for the money. She got trigger happy, killed the rest of them, and then he's like, "What the fuck are you doing?" Kills her.
Oh, okay.
That's what I mean.
So the law enforcement, whatever he was, the drug person, must have seen her going into the house, not going out of the house, because she would have been dead.
No. This is before the.
Yeah.
This is before the killings. So he's obviously said that he saw a woman in black, didn't he? Kill the family, but not me. We don't mean any offence.
So as George has now explained the potential crime just to me then, could this have been the original plan? And could Dawn and Ronald have gone to kill their parents for insurance reasons? And then Dawn got carried away, killed all the siblings, and then Ronald turned around and literally killed her?
It could be. I think that's actually quite a, you know, believable sort of thing, because I don't believe that one guy would plan to kill his whole family, and I reckon maybe she was really sadistic and like, actually I hate the family, let's fucking shoot them all. Who knows? Obviously she is now a victim. This is all speculation, so I don't know, but it is a police, I think it might be a potential police theory.
Yeah, definitely. That was kind of a documentary we've watched. That was one of the, I couldn't tell you who, but one of the detectives kind of said that's what he still thinks this day is what's happened.
And it, to be fair, it kind of does make sense. And as we've always said, it's not unheard of by any, like, you know, form of the imagination. However, though, bizarrely, the neighbours did not report hearing any gunshots being fired. And those who were awake at the time of the murders simply heard the family sheepdog, Shaggy, barking.
Do you ever get it when you hear fireworks?
Yes, they've been going off the last two nights.
Yeah. And then I'm always like, oh my God, someone's been shot. Do you ever do that?
Literally never. Never do that.
I always... If I hear a firework past 10 o'clock, I'm like, oh my God.
We live in Bristol, not Brooklyn.
People have been shot outside my window. Yeah. And I peek out. It's like, pretty firework. If you hear a dog barking, you'll hear a gunshot.
Yeah, that's true. I see what you're saying. But no, they've been going off at like 2 o'clock. On randomly for like one or two the past two nights, and it's pissed me off. I'm like, what are you doing? Why aren't you doing it at like 11?
Sure, it's not gang crime.
Pretty sure it's not gang crime. So, what are the supernatural stories? As all of you are aware, I'm sure this is a huge, massively popular haunted tale, I suppose. It's considered to be one of the most haunted houses in America. So the Amityville House was originally used to house Native Americans that were insane, sick or withering. Those Indians were buried on the property, obviously from less than peaceful circumstances. Did these Indians, buried on unconsecrated ground, lend to the later strange tragedy that would make this house so famous? And why is there always a bloody Indian burial ground? I'm surprised this isn't a Stephen King movie.
Literally like Pet Sematary.
It literally is. Don't do it, Tom. I know what you're thinking. Don't go up to Pet Sematary. That was my really good impression of him. That was mint. I didn't
always... so good.
Thank you.
In December 1975, 13 months after the Defeo family were murdered, George and Kathy Lutz bought the six-bedroom Amityville home. And this home had access to a swimming pool, a boathouse, and they just bought it for $80,000. But they did know that, you know, what happened in this house. The realtor gave them full disclosure and informed George and Kathy about the murders which had taken place there. They were obviously unfazed, and the family went about their daily life in the home. So from an outsider's point of view, so from our point of view, it is a dream home. I would fucking love a swimming pool in my house.
Might have been right next to the lake, which is why they had access to the boathouse. But in America, they always swim in lakes, don't they?
So obviously it was too good to be true. And the Lutz family only actually lasted 28 days in the home. So what happened? So the Lutz and their five young children, three of which were from a previous marriage of Kathy's, started their life in their new home. George decided to call a priest and bless the house due to its past. Father Ralph J.
Pucker.
But Father Ralph is just such a father just name, isn't it?
We're going to rename him Father
we're
Ralph.
We're going to Ralph. Father Ralph came to bless the home for any wanted spirits. And the priest went round and continued to bless various areas of the house, only to be told by a mysterious voice to get out.
No. He wasn't Scottish. Shit. So after this was when the paranormal occurrences started to happen. Almost immediately, George became volatile after moving into the home. He would also wake at the same time every morning, 3:15 a.m. The same time Ronald DeFeo Jr. had committed the mass murders. Insomnia or paranormal? Who knows? Other reports from the family include the usual Exorcist shit, like objects flying around the room, walls oozing with green slime, and a crucifix on one of the walls turning upside down. You know, the huge. There was also reports of a hidden red room in the basement. So, this red room was on the housing floor plan, but was previously used just as a cleaning cupboard. However, reports say that the room smelt of blood and was painted in red, and the Lutz family dog wouldn't go near it. They stated that he was actually terrified. So that's, I always find that a bit unnerving when a dog starts whimpering.
This is true, but if the room was red, dogs don't like red, do they?
Don't they?
Anyway, that's balls.
Oh, fuck's sake.
One of the Lutz children, Missy, the five-year-old, met an invisible friend named Jodie. And we have discussed imaginary friends before on this podcast, so you all know that. We all had one. Except for, who didn't have one? You didn't have one.
I made one up.
Okay, George made one up.
I wanted to have one, so I made one up. But I couldn't actually see her.
But I had imaginary friends. Jenny had imaginary friends. I had like five. Well, I had one that was renamed five times. So it seems pretty normal to us. But mine never looked like a demonic pig.
Neither did mine. It has to be said.
No. And Missy's was a demonic pig. So could this be a child's mind or something a lot more sinister? So if you kind of watch the film, what's it called? It's just called Amityville Horror, isn't it?
I think it's called Amityville Horror.
The one with Ryan Reynolds in it?
That's the one. That's where I've got my first crush on him. I was like, you sexy bit of beef.
He is nice. But the imaginary friend in that film is decapitated.
No.
No.
She's not decapitated. She is depicted. Twat.
Hell. So she is depicted as one of the murdered DeFeo children, which makes a lot more sense than decapitated, because none of them were decapitated.
No.
As far as we know, unless that's another conspiracy theory.
It's probably. In the film, she's quite freaky though. She's got a little bullet hole in her head.
She does, yeah.
I googled it. Yeah. But then that makes sense to the whole DeFeo family being murdered. Yeah.
So Kathy Lutz also claimed to have frequent nightmares about the DeFeo murders. She also claimed that she'd been embraced by an unseen force and welts were supposedly seen on her body in the morning. So I'm guessing that's like sores or like pussy sores.
Yeah, I think welts are like, yeah, skin. A skin problem. I think it's like a boil or something. I'm not entirely sure.
Yeah, and she also claimed to have levitated.
The family had known what had happened to the previous family. This could have played on their minds and in their subconscious and in their dreams. It's amazing what your brain can convince you of, although when it comes to the levitation, it's up to you what you make of that. Most notable of Kathy Lutz's imaginative tales was a tale of the cloven hoof prints seen in the snow outside the home. However, upon further investigation, there was no snow on Long Island at any point during the Lutz family residence. So what do you make of that? Is the house haunted, or could it be a money scam? The Lutz family had many books and films created based on their events in those 28 days. George and Kathy Lutz stood by their story for their entire lives. George and Kathy never changed their story until their deaths. They maintained what was in the book was mostly true. So, yeah, I suppose it's up to you what you make of that. I like to think that some of these things are true, because it's quite cool.
Yeah, I always, until I kind of looked into this case, I didn't really think of it not being true, if you know what I mean. And now, looking into this case, it does seem like it was all a bit of a scam. And that is my opinion. So in June 1979... George and Kathy took a lie detector test concerning the events in the house, and they passed. So obviously lie detector tests, you'll hear it on TV and podcasts all the time. You just can't get by a lie detector test. Unless you go on Jeremy Kyle, you cannot.
Jeremy Kyle is the only one that says this lie detector test is true. And what I say goes. You're actually bang on right there. I didn't think about that. Jeremy Kyle is the only one who uses it as a true form of evidence.
And even that now he can't use because it's been taken off air. Because
it's been shut down.
It's been shut the fuck down.
Shut that shit down.
Even 25 years after their time in the Amityville, in a documentary on the History Channel, George said, "I believe this has stayed alive for 25 years because it's a true story. It doesn't mean that everything that has been ever said about it is true. It is certainly not a hoax. It's really easy to call something a hoax. I wish it was. It's not." Over the years, the house has been subject to many paranormal investigations, but maybe notoriously, the house was investigated by Ed and Lorraine Warren.
Ed and Lorraine were initially called to the house by a Channel 5 NY reporter that they'd actually worked with before, and Lorraine claims that before she'd even stepped foot into the Amityville house, she felt uneasy. And it was literally after taking the call and asked the clergy to go with them to back her up spiritually. And I'm sure most of you are aware that Lorraine Warren is a self-professed clairvoyant. So, you know, she's a bit of a psychic, she gets like feelings, she can get like premonitions, she can see shit. So this is actually one of their most famous cases, and although sadly both Ed and Lorraine Warren have now passed away, with Lorraine literally only passing in April this year, this was a case they refused to discuss whilst in a moving vehicle, as when they did, well, if you read the quotes, she wouldn't even go into detail then about what happened in their car. So, most famously, however, this was during the investigation, a photo was taken by Ed and Lorraine's photographer, who worked with them frequently, and it's, you probably all seen it, we're going to put it on the Instagram. It's a picture of a ghostly looking boy with white eyes peeking around a door. It is pretty freaky. It's really, really notorious. I think it's like probably one of the first ever ghost pictures that they say ghost caught on camera or whatever. So there's some speculation that it's actually John Matthew, the youngest DeFeo boy, but obviously that is just speculation. There is sort of similarities if you put the two pictures together. You're like, oh yeah, I can kind of see that. He might be that ghost kid. But, you know, with everything being said and the untimely death of the DeFeo family, which we didn't really dive into too much because we wanted to throw some spook onto this episode, what do you believe happened at the Amityville? Do you believe it was a haunting that had always been there, which caused Ronald DeFeo Jr. to commit these murders? Or do you think it was just a boy who was on drugs, had drug problems, wanted the money, killed his whole family? And then do you think the Lutz family were just in on it for, again, a money scam?
I think it's haunted.
I do too. Them darned American burial grounds.
I think it's got at the bottom of the basement. It's got one of those big concrete burial grounds, and it has blood that will come at 3:15 every night that will go through the moats.
The moats.
And then whoever's living there...
It's not a castle.
Whoever's living there gets possessed by the demon.
Yeah, because isn't it what they say is that the three is an insult, anything to do with three is an insult to the Holy Trinity. I think that was what they said in The Conjuring, and that is true because I have read one of their books. Mm. Pay them back. as in Ed and Lorraine Warren's book. But yeah, it's an insult to the, is it the God, the Father and the Holy Ghost?
Mm.
So like three knocks, 3 a.m. It's seen as the witching hour, isn't it, I think?
Yeah, yeah.
Is another term for it. So stuff happening at that time, like if I wake up at that time and I heard something, I'd shit myself. But I tend to not look at the clock unless I really need a wee.
Yeah, I also do think it is weird, like, yeah, I can get that it's not anything supernatural, but they were all found lying face down in their beds, no struggle, one gun, like, it doesn't, yeah, it can completely be logical, but then in a way, I think that's probably where it started, the fact that it is so, such a weird circumstance of how they were found.
Yeah, because I mean, not, I can't imagine anyone like deep sleep through that.
Mm.
Like a bloody rifle going off in your house.
Yeah.
Multiple times. No, I mean, at the end of the day, it's happened, unfortunately, the DeFeo family. Unfortunately, the DeFeo family have passed, so, you know, you can't actually ask them any further questions. We hope you like this take on the Amityville and our thoughts on it and our own little horror stories.
Tell us so what you think as well.
Yeah, I mean, leave it in the comments.
Mm, yeah,
you don't really need to.
Well, you can tell me what you think.
It's haunted.
It's haunted. No, our lovely listeners, it would be nice for you to tell us what you think.
Yeah, all two of you.
Me and Georgia. We listen back.
Yes. I'm listen number one on our podcast.
Jenny, sick note, tell us what you think of the Amityville Horror.
But yeah, just let us know on the comments or anything, or just, you know, send us a cheeky little email. But before we end the episode, we are going to obviously say, you know, give us a like and a follow and a share on the usuals, Instagram. Send us an email at girlstalkcrime@gmail.com. So that's the end of our official episode. But before we're ending it, we're going to pop you on to Jenny's pre-recorded creepypasta creepy tales.
The shed. The shed was old and weather-beaten, and it leaned to one side. It sat at the furthest edge of the backyard, backed by thick woods that signalled the edge of the Warrens' property. The only thing contemporary about the shack was its deadbolt lock, meant to keep out everyone but the family's patriarch, Jack Warren, who guarded its contents as if they were precious religious artefacts. 10-year-old Evan Warren knew the rule about staying away from the shed, but being a kid, he was achingly curious about what his father was hiding. Mother never talked about it, and always changed the subject when the shed was mentioned. One day, Evan and his younger brother Jeb were playing catch in the backyard on a crisp fall day, when Jeb missed a pass and the ball tumbled across the grass, coming to a stop near the shed door. When Evan went to retrieve the ball, he noticed that the door was ajar. "Whoa," said Evan to Jeb. "Look, Dad must have forgotten to lock it." "Come on," urged Evan. "Let's check it out." "No way. Dad will skin us alive if we go in there." "Chicken, I'm going in." A frightened Jeb ran back to the house without looking back. That night, Jeb came down to dinner and saw three places set instead of four. His mother's eyes were red, as if she'd been crying. His father was carving a roast. "Where's Evan?" he asked. "I don't know anyone named Evan," answered his father, "and neither do you." The pills. My husband had been a godsend since I got sick. My doctors were really stumped at first, but we figured it out. The doctor prescribed me a medicine to take every 6 hours. It was supposed to help with the pain. My husband was an excellent nurse. At first, I hated to have him do it. My illness was turning me into a person I just didn't recognise anymore. I was moody, temperamental, and very impatient. But my husband just kept going, giving me those tiny blue-green pills that would help cure my ails. But my symptoms worsened. My nose kept bleeding profusely. My husband left a message with the doctor, but No response. I started to develop bruises all over my body, and my stomach was always upset. The doctor apparently thought this could be solved by an increase in my medicine, so I began taking it every 4 hours. I smiled pitifully at my husband, thanking him for his devotion, and swallowing that small bluish pill. He ran a gentle hand through my hair, and a fistful of my hair came out along with it. I cried and cried, but I just needed to be alone. I sent my husband to the shop. A few minutes after he left, I realised that I needed to take a dose. I weakly climbed out of bed and made it to the medicine cabinet. There were those tiny blue pills scattered loosely around the cabinet. I grabbed the pill bottle and unscrewed the cap to try and dump them back in the bottle. But that's when I saw it. My pills were white.